You know, we live in a society and in a world that is really driven by violence and power. And I'm going to use as my illustration TV and movies, which is, you know, the best illustration, I think, of that. You know, when I was growing up, it seemed like in all the movies and TV shows, the heroes were always the guys who won the fist fights. You know, you ever think about that? You always had to have a good right or a good left. I guess lefties are represented too, but... And every generation had it, you know. So, you know, you might be in the John Wayne generation. So he was the hero guy for you. I was in the Harrison Ford generation. Was really sorry to hear about his plane crash, but I think he's okay. So I was a little nervous there. Allie especially likes Harrison Ford. Now, if you're in, you know, the younger generation, then maybe it's Matt Damon. Now, maybe he's old too. I don't know. It's just that I'm thinking of all the Bourne movies. And but, you know, for all those generations, you think about it, that's the hero. It's the guy who levels the bad guy, you know, at the end of the movie. And I remember watching MASH as a kid. And you remember how they portrayed Father Mulcahy. He was the priest. And he was obviously opposed to violence. You know, he just sort of went with the job, I guess. He wasn't into violence, which is sort of ironic because he's here in the middle of a bloody battlefield, you know, this war that's going on. But it really distinguished him from the other characters. And sometimes, you know, he got a little ribbing about it. And one of his famous lines was, "Remember what the good book says, love thy neighbor, or I'll punch your lights out." And you know, the reason it's funny is that he almost never punched somebody's lights out. You know, that just wasn't the way he was. But I think there was. I was reading through this page on him, and evidently there was one episode where he punched somebody for some penicillin or something, you know, to save the children. But he was like, you know, he's like the anti-hero's hero because he was different. Our culture, though, I think, in a lot of ways, has conditioned us to retaliation. Now, of course, we can't blame it on our culture. Well, we could, but we shouldn't, because it's what the culture is doing is it's bringing out what is already inside of us. We are born with, and this is not necessarily a bad thing, we are born with this innate sense of justice, and that justice wants to defend the weak by doing violence against those who perpetrate violence. And I think this is more relevant than ever for Christians right now because, you know, as you know, if you listen to the news, we have this organization that is killing Christians in large numbers. And not only Christians, you know, to be fair, there are other cults, other Muslim sects, and other religions that ISIS is killing as well. But I think we could agree, they are specifically targeting Christians and Christian relics. And any reference to the Christian faith, they want to root out and destroy. And you know, they're not just doing it in the Middle East, but their threat is to do this on the lawn of the White House. I mean, they want to bring this, they want a worldwide caliphate. And, you know, when I see the videos of executions by these ISIS people, I have to be honest, I have a strong desire to procure a high-caliber machine gun and kill them all. I just do. And I know that doesn't sound very Christian, doesn't sound very pastoral, but that's what I want to do. I have this rage that just creeps up inside of me. And I mean, I'm assuming that you do too, unless, you know, you're just more naturally peaceful than me and the rest of us. But that is our natural reaction. So here's the problem. What do we do with this passage? Because it obviously says we're not supposed to do that. Do we relegate it to the margins of our Bibles or society? Do we kind of half pretend it's not there, pretend it only applies in certain situations? Well, that's not an option. We have to wrestle with what Paul says here that seems to go so counter against what we feel inside. Last week we were looking at how Christians are to love one another. And sometimes that's really hard because Christians don't always act like Christians. But I think verses 14 to 21 are a lot harder to live out, and that's why it's so important that we need to talk about this. We need to hear it now, and I think we may need to hear it more and more in the years to come. We have lived in a bubble in our country for many, many, for hundreds of years, and it's quite possible that may be changing. But I've titled this Love the Other, meaning we're called to love people outside the church as well as inside. And the subtitle is Kingdom Values in a Broken World. I probably would have picked this as a title, but I'd already picked another one and it was too late. But this is, I think, the heart of what Paul is saying here. We have to live in the world as it really is, right? We don't get to choose what the world is like. We might like, you know, we might wish that. And this is what Paul is preparing us for. And this is one of the biggest misconceptions about the Christian faith. It's not this idea of pie in the sky, that, you know, these people that are living in an ivory tower, living somehow detached from the reality of the world. The Christian faith was forged in violent injustice. It began in the first century, which was one of the bloodier centuries of history, and it's continuing today, which I think, you know, many statisticians have said the 20th century was actually the bloodiest in history. And so the Christian faith actually teaches us how to live in a world of violent injustice. And it's a good thing, don't you think? So what does it look like to love the other? A few things as an outline if you want to follow along in your bulletin. First thing is we must feel with God's heart. So I want to start with verse 15. I'm going to skip over 14 for you, logical progression people. You know, just get over that. We'll come back to it. Verse 15 says, "Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep." So Paul says we're called to share others' joy as well as bearing their pain. James Edwards says, "Our joy and sorrow are too easily measured by personal gain or loss rather than by the cause of Christ." So he's saying that when we look when we look at joy and sorrow through the lens of God's plan, of his big picture of rescuing people from their sin through Jesus, when we look at it through that lens, we can actually more fully be happy for happy people and grieve with grieving people. When we factor in what God is doing, it's a better lens to look at it through. Because then we can move out of our own experiences and out of ourselves. And we have to realize, God has a whole lot more compassion than we do. And there are a lot of times when we need to borrow his heart. And we need to see things, we need to feel things through his heart. John Chrysostom was one of the early church fathers, and he said it requires more of a high Christian temper to rejoice with them that rejoice than to weep with them that weep. Now, you know, it's not hard to be happy with somebody else when you're happy for the same reason that they are. You know, it was easy to rejoice with my sons when Malcolm Butler intercepted that pass from Russell Wilson in the Super Bowl. You know, that was really not that hard. I was very happy. I was rejoicing with those who rejoice. I don't think that's what Paul's talking about, however. It's harder to be happy for your friend when your friend gets a job that you really wanted, isn't it? Or your friend gets accepted into the college that you really wanted to get accepted into but didn't. I think that's more what Paul's talking about. It requires a selflessness that only God's love can engender in us. And it requires a love that comes from outside. We don't have it naturally inside. Now, it's difficult to weep with those who weep too. And I don't know if this is unique to New England. It may not be. It may be more universal, but oftentimes we don't want to grieve with other people, do we? We don't know what to say. We feel awkward. Maybe we feel like we have enough problems of our own. Oftentimes we'll say of people that are grieving, "Well, I just want to give them their space." You know, you've probably said that. I know I have. But that's not what they need, is it? Somebody who's grieving needs someone to hold them and to let them weep. That's what people need. I remember when my friend Steve's son committed suicide a number of years ago, Allie told me that I should go and see him. And she needed to because I wouldn't have gone. I didn't want to go for all the reasons that I just mentioned. I felt awkward. I didn't know what to say. But I went. And when I met him, all I could say was, "Steve, I'm so sorry." That's all I knew how to say. And I just held him and I just let him cry. And, I don't think I said much of anything else for the hour or two that I was there. I didn't even know his son. That's one of the reasons I felt awkward going. But I'll never forget that how much it meant to him later, what he told me later, what an impact it had. I sat there, I heard stories, I listened to people talk about Sam, and then I left. But you see, my wife recognized that being there in that moment for Steve would be important, not just for him in that moment, but also for our relationship forever. You see, our presence with people in the best times and the worst times of their lives, in a way, defines our relationship for all the times in between. And it's really, really true. I have seen this bear out over and over and over, not just in my, you know, personal life, so to speak, but in my ministry. If you are there with somebody you care about when things are really hard and when they're really good, that sets the tone for the rest of your relationship, for all the regular stuff in between. That's when they need you. And, you know, you probably, well, all of us, I think, have had experiences where we haven't been there for somebody in those times, and that's hard. You know, you can't be everywhere, but as much as possible. As difficult as it was for me to be there in that moment for Steve, what little presence of mine I had came from an experience I had in seminary. I was taking a class in some kind of practical ministry, and we had to do an overnight chaplaincy at Presbyterian Hospital in Charlotte. And so we had to stay overnight, sleep overnight, and be on call as the chaplain at the hospital. And most of the night passed, you know, with nothing at all going on. And then all of a sudden I got a call to labor and delivery where a baby had just been stillborn. And this family had no warning. They had no idea that their baby was dead. And I walked in within minutes of the delivery of this little girl. And I had never met this couple before, and I've never seen them since. But I was there for them in the probably the worst moment in their lives. And I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what to say. And I said virtually the same thing I said to Steve. I'm so sorry. And I just wept with them. I listened to them talk about their family. I did whatever I could to help them in whatever they're doing. I helped them say goodbye to their child. I prayed with them. I told them about a story about King David and about his conviction that he was going to see his child again. This was a family who, you know, they were professing Christians. But it was something that I felt absolutely and completely unequipped, ill-equipped, and unprepared for. And I don't know that there's any way you can be. We see God's heart at the grave of Lazarus, you know, the shortest verse in the Bible, John 11:35. All your kids have memorized it. Jesus wept. Jesus wept at Lazarus's grave, even though he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead. You ever thought about that? Why would he weep? He knows he's going to live. But I don't think Jesus wept for Lazarus. I think he wept for death itself, the scourge that death was on the human race. And I think he wept for what it came from, the fall, just everything, how death had affected humanity. When we feel with God's heart, we feel what brings him joy and what causes him grief. And then we're more able to genuinely feel joy and genuinely feel sorrow with other people. All right, second way that we love each other, according to Paul, is to see with God's eyes. Verse 16 says this, "Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight." Paul's telling us to see ourselves and each other the way God sees us. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, we have to be omniscient. That would be really hard. Actually, impossible. What it means is seeing people honestly the way they really are, rather than inflated, you know, because of pride, or denigrated through indignity, treating them as less than they are. And in verse 16, the Greek word for think appears three times. So here's a kind of a little more literal reading. Have this mind among yourselves. That's the first one. Do not think inflated things. Do not be wise in yourselves. That's the third time. Now, we talked last week, I think it was last week, about the way society clamors for self-esteem, that this is viewed as the biggest problem with society. And yet the Bible seems to really temper that and say, no, that's actually, that's the biggest, you know, the biggest problem is we have too much, not too little. Paul is not telling us to put ourselves or other people down, but he's telling us our natural tendency is to pump each other up or pump ourselves up. R.C. Sproul tells a fascinating story about the Greek philosopher Plato, a story that Plato told about men that were captive in a cave since childhood. I think this was make-believe. I hope so. I'm pretty sure it was. But they were chained against the wall of a cave so that they couldn't see anything but the wall in front of them. And above them, there were people walking around, and there were candles lit. And so they could see reflections of the shadows of the people walking around reflected on the wall in front of them, but they couldn't actually see the people. So their only perception of reality came from the shadows that they saw. Eventually, Plato goes on to say, the prisoners were freed, and it was only when they came out into the daylight that they could see how different reality was from their perceptions. And Plato told the story to draw a distinction between knowledge and opinion. So in Plato's view, opinion is the dancing shadow on the wall. It doesn't bear really, it bears very little resemblance to reality. I mean, you know, your kids have seen it when they're walking with the shadows, and their shadow's like, you know, 18 feet long. It bears a slight resemblance, but it's all out of proportion. And think about how true this is in terms of opinion versus fact. How many times have you gotten in a conflict or a fight with somebody over an assumption that you made that was wrong? You know, and you were convinced that it was right, but it wasn't. And then you realize later that whole argument was based on a flaw, you know, in your perception. And having wrong opinions is unavoidable. We can't help it. We can't be right all the time. Some of you are, but more than others don't. We can't be right all the time. You know, we're going to be wrong. The question is, are you going to be willing to admit it? Are you willing to own it when you're wrong? Or is the price too high? There are a lot of things in life that we should take seriously, but our own opinions are not among them. We ought to take seriously the content of what we believe, but not our own feelings about it, not our own perceptions. We need to draw that distinction. Because if that's true, if we can take ourselves lightly and the way we perceive things, but actually take very seriously the content of what we believe, we'll be able to associate with those of low position. You're not going to consider yourself above somebody else because you don't value the way you think as above somebody else. And so what Paul says here, never be wise in your own sight, goes along with Proverbs 27:2. Let another man praise you and not your own lips. It's a really, really, really good verse, but it's not one we often hold to, is it? So we can see with God's eyes when we see people as both people of dignity, in other words, people created in God's image, and people of depravity. By virtue of being victims of the fall, that's tarnished that image. Those two truths we always hold in tension. We cannot forget one or the other. If you do, it totally distorts the way you view people. And what that does is it helps us not to respect some other and not others. It helps us not to be respecters of persons, as sort of the old KJV put it. It takes away the aura of the rich, whose possessions make them seem higher, and our condescension towards the poor that makes them seem lower. Because really, we're all the same. We all stand before God naked and exposed with nothing whatsoever to commend ourselves to him. We have some friends who we went to high school and college with. Allie graduated with her, I graduated with him. And they got married the year before we did and have been friends all the way along. And we both lived in South Carolina for the first few years of our marriage, and both of us were struggling. You know, young couple, you're sort of scrapping things together to make ends meet. But at the very beginning, they actually were struggling more than us. And I remember one time sitting in my friend's car, and we had just gotten a new to us car. It was, you know, a little nicer. And I sat in and I thought, wow, this is really rough. I mean, the seats are all torn, and wow, this is in really bad shape. And that sort of came back to haunt me later. So, you know, time went on, and we also got a house first, and you know, so some of those first things we got before them. Well, then his mortgage business began to prosper, and things changed. And then they bought a house, and it was a lot nicer than ours, a lot bigger, a lot better. And they got nicer cars and newer cars. And I remember a few years after that first observation I had, sitting in my car with his son, and his son made some disparaging comment about my car. And I was like, how things have changed. I was just glad that, you know, originally I had not opened my mouth. You know, it's like, don't, you know, if you're going to be a fool, don't open your mouth and remove all doubt. You know, let people at least wonder. But what was interesting was that our friendship hadn't changed. And, you know, it's a little kid. They say dumb things, you know. And as they became more wealthy, they didn't change. They in fact, were very humble and very generous. They gave me my first laptop when I was fundraising for the church plant and needed it to, you know, go around to churches and do my PowerPoint thing. They gave us a car when we got ready to move up here. Just tremendously generous. And today they're quite wealthy. But it's not hard for me to view them the way I always have, because A, they haven't changed, and B, I knew them, you know, when they had virtually nothing. And our friendship is the same. But it's not that way with most people, is it? You know, if you're dealing with people who have a lot more possessions than you do, it's really difficult not to view them differently. And it's the same way when you're talking to somebody who has way less possessions than you. Very difficult not to view them differently. But what Paul is saying here is, by God's grace, we need to see people with God's eyes. Okay, the third aspect of loving the other is to trust in God's justice. And this is the hardest one by far. Verse 14, and then we'll skip on down to 17. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay," says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, I read all those verses together because they really give us multiple facets of one truth. Love your enemies. You know, that's what he's saying. Love those who don't love you. The only way that we can love our enemies is to trust in God's justice. I mentioned at the beginning my natural reaction to these videos that I see of terrorists killing innocent people. That is our natural response. But here's the stunning truth. As Christians, we are not bound to our natural response. In fact, we are different people. We are changed people because God has changed our hearts. We are called to a considered response. That's the way Paul puts it in verse 17. We're called to give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. James Edwards made a great point about this. He said, it's no accident that Paul mentions associating with the lowly in verse 16 and then not repaying evil in 17. Because what happens when you identify with people who are oppressed or persecuted? What usually happens? More than likely, you'll get oppressed and persecuted. You know, you identify with them, you become one with them, you're gonna receive the same treatment that they are. And that's one of the reasons we struggle to do it. When Martin Luther said something really helpful, I think, on this topic. He said, "Men commonly regard as the victor the one who has the last word and can deal the last blow." I thought that was funny, thinking of Martin Luther punching somebody out. It was a hard image. Now, I don't know if he was talking about himself, but it's interesting to think about what this looked like in the 16th century. Times really have not changed that much. People are people. So he says, "Men commonly regard as the victor the one who has the last word can deal the last blow. Whereas, as a matter of fact, he who is the last to inflict pain is the one who's worse off, for the evil remains with him while the other is done with it." Interesting, isn't it? The last one to inflict pain is the worse off. In other words, when we inflict pain, there's something that stays with us. Now, I want to give you a totally contrasting illustration to Martin Luther. Spider-Man 3. This is for the other side. Peter Parker goes to his Aunt May in Spider-Man 3, and he announces that Spider-Man killed Flint Marko. Now, if you know your Spider-Man, you know that Flint Marko killed Uncle Ben some years before. And Uncle Ben is Aunt May's husband. So you got all the relationships going here. So Peter expects Aunt May to be happy because she loved Aunt Ben, and she would want justice for his killer. But she's confused, and she looks at him, and she says, "Wait a minute, Spider-Man doesn't kill people. And Peter is taken aback, and he says, well, he deserved to die, didn't he? And Aunt May says something very profound. I know you didn't think there was anything profound in Spider-Man. She says, I don't think it's for any of us to decide if someone deserves to die. She said, your uncle wouldn't want any of us living with revenge in our hearts. It's like a poison. It takes you over. Now, Aunt May was right, wasn't she? Nancy Leigh DeMoss said, fooling around with bitterness is like fooling around with poison and hoping somebody else will die. You see, we cannot dole out revenge and unforgiveness and bitterness against other people and somehow think we're going to be spared the effects. It doesn't work that way. It rubs off. It actually is more destructive on the person who gives it out. Now, I want to give you three tools to help you, to help us, to trust in God's justice. The first one is to reflect God's patience. Look at verse 18. Paul says, as far as it depends on us, live peaceably with all men. Now, his qualifier is very important. It's not always possible, is it? Peace cannot compromise truth. Peace cannot kowtow to evil. And this is a huge misconception. You know, many people think those who don't retaliate are somehow weak-willed. They're too afraid of a fight. Nothing could be further than the truth. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was quoted in our bulletin, stood up to Hitler, participated in a plot to assassinate Hitler. But when he was arrested and imprisoned and eventually executed, he did not retaliate. Bonhoeffer is such a sterling example of a life lived by principle and not convenience. He knew what he stood for, and even against the advice and of a lot of people. A lot of people were distressed with some of the actions that he carried out, but he lived his life by conviction. But you see, most of the time, most of us can live in peace. We're not forced into the situations he was forced into. You know, we don't need to look for a fight. A lot of people around us do. Our friend Winnie, you heard John praying for her. Winnie is a student at Southern New Hampshire University, just returned from China. She brought her son Harry, and she had a car accident recently, and she's been driving again, and she understandably is driving a lot slower since her accident, besides the fact that she's still learning English and she's in America, you know, a different country. So she's driving a lot more slowly, and she said that people honk their horns. She couldn't think of the word for horn. She said, people do this. They honk their horns and they yell curses and they, you know, gesture curses at her. And I feel terrible for her because, you know, this woman's trying to go to school full time, trying to parent this child who doesn't know any English, you know, who's in a new school in a new country. It's just an incredible challenge. And she said, Barbara and I were talking to her the other day, and she said in tears, she said, sometimes I don't want to live. It's so overwhelming what she's trying to do, and yet she feels driven to do it, that this is something she really needs to do. But Winnie said something very important, I think, told us something very important. She said when she went to a church in China, this was a house church, met in somebody's apartment, like, you know, the vast majority of underground churches, at least, in China. They were taking prayer requests like we would do, you know, in a prayer meeting or a service here. And she said that the pastor said, we need to pray for our enemies. So what enemies would you like us to pray for? I bet you haven't done that in any of your prayer meetings. I haven't done it in mine. I think in China they understand this a lot better than we do. God is patient even with those who curse him. And by his grace, we need to reflect his patience. The second part of trusting his justice is resting in his wrath. Paul says, not to avenge ourselves, but to give place, literally give place to the wrath. And the implication is God's wrath. God is a just judge. He's going to judge evil one day in a way that he doesn't always choose to judge it now. Sometimes he does. Many times he doesn't. The only reason that we can hold back from retaliation and revenge many times is knowing that he is going to judge. I read a few articles this week about the whole concept of karma. It's kind of a new idea to me, and it's something I don't really understand a lot about. And there was this one article by a Buddhist scholar who was correcting misconceptions about karma. And one of the things that he said is that karma does not encourage retaliation. Some people sort of have this notion that it does. And he said, karma has more to do with the way your actions shape you. In other words, you live your life, you live your life a certain way, it's going to shape your life, you know, in succeeding reincarnations. This is not what we believe. This is, you know, this is Hindu/Buddhist beliefs of karma. So what he said, and this is, you know, your actions shape you for better or for worse, depending on what you do. So one, the scholar said, since the Buddha did not acknowledge the presence of a theistic power, karma would not be associated with an external objective judge. And then he goes on to quote somebody else who says, we are the authors of our own destiny, and being the authors, we are ultimately free. I just thought that was so ironic, because if there's no judge, who decides what's good and what's bad? Then, and also, if there's no judge, it's certainly true that I am free to do the right thing. But I don't always do the right thing, do I? And neither do you. What if I don't do the right thing? What if in my freedom I choose the wrong thing? Then, because there's no judge, I am condemned. There's no judge, there's no justice. There is no way to correct the wrong that I bring on myself. There's no one to set me free from the consequences of my own sin. That's the problem. And Paul tells us, thank God, that there is indeed a judge, and we can rest in his wrath. There was a malicious man in Jonathan Edwards' congregation. Jonathan Edwards is a pastor in Northampton, Massachusetts in the 1700s. And this man accused Edwards unjustly of sin. And Edwards was kicked out of his parish in Northampton. So when Edwards' friends heard the charges, they knew that they were wrong. They knew that he hadn't done these things. And they went to Edwards and said, why don't you defend yourself? Why do you, you know, keep quiet and let this, you know, this false accusation stand? And Edwards said, although he wanted to be vindicated, he feared that if he was the one vindicating himself, his efforts couldn't compare with what God was going to do to vindicate him one day at the judgment. And we look at that and we say, you idiot. We don't say that about Jonathan Edwards, but his actions seem foolish to us, because we're so intent on our rights and on our righteousness. Because, you know, from our perspective, he risked lifelong injustice. And for us, nothing could be worse. But you see, in Edward's case, what was interesting was that his accuser was so overcome with conscience that after 10 years, he confessed to the congregation that he had lied about Jonathan Edwards. Now, Jonathan Edwards, as far as I know, never, you know, he wasn't reinstated in the parish, but he was vindicated on earth. Now, that doesn't always happen. In his case, it did. But the only reason, the point of this is, the only reason that Jonathan Edwards could bear the injustice that he suffered for 10 years was because he served a just judge who would vindicate him in the end. All right, the final way that we can trust in God's justice is to share in God's loss and his gain. Paul says we should not only not retaliate against our enemy, but we should serve him and feed him and meet his needs. Show him kindness. Again, this is really, really hard. And then Paul says, by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Now, this always confused me as a child. I'm like, okay, why would you want to heap? Well, I can understand why you would want to heap burning coals on the head of your enemy. But why is Paul telling us we're supposed to do this? No, Paul is not saying that you're actually in a backhanded way trying to kill your enemy. What he's saying, we're not really 100% sure what that phrase means, but there are two options. Either it means you're going to produce shame in him. He's going to be ashamed of his actions. Or it's going to change his heart. Your kindness is going to change his heart. So either way, loving our enemy, showing kindness to our enemy, is the antidote to the poison of revenge. It frees us from the tyranny of retaliation. You see, the way to overcome evil with good is to put into practice the principle that God demonstrated towards us. The power of the cross of Jesus Christ is that a supremely innocent victim gave his life for the perpetrators. And the way C.S. Lewis put it was when a traitor, an innocent traitor died, I'm sorry, an innocent victim died in a traitor's stead, and death itself worked backwards. Now, we have to realize, if we're going to live that out, we're not Jesus. Okay, we're not supremely innocent. We're at best relatively innocent. But as we put into principle the concept of grace, loving our enemies, it cuts the legs out from under the power of evil. When we forgive those who wrong us, when we take the loss, we also experience the gain. Because the need to be justified here on earth loosens its hold a little bit. It requires infinitely more strength to return good for evil, and it allows the power of the gospel to do its work. And it gives a testimony to the power of the gospel, doesn't it? When we live that way, people can more clearly understand how Jesus could die for them. Don't let the enemy suck you into the vortex of retaliation. Trust in God to do justice. And we know that he will. How do we know that he will? Because he already did. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, I thank you for these hard words from the Apostle Paul. They are hard words because this is not the way we want to live many times. Maybe it is the way we want to live in a vacuum, but it's not the way we want to live in the heat of the moment when somebody does something to us. We want to retaliate. But Lord, I pray that you would work the grace in us that you have shown to us in the gospel. Help us to live gospel-centered lives, lives that are the what we do, how we live is informed by the grace that we have received. And Lord, as we do that, people are going to see Jesus more clearly in us. So please, Lord, help us. Give us the grace. We need it desperately. That's why we need the Lord's Supper. We need your grace working in our lives. So please help us. And as you do, Lord, we'll give you glory and praise. And I believe, we believe, many people will come to know you as a result. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.